At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. That guy over there, that's Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Howdy.
Hey, we made a mention of it yesterday, but I want to make sure that I talk about it again today. People are still looking for interesting movies and things to watch that have a strange supernatural slant to them.
Yep.
I really want to recommend, like I said, this is one of my favorite movies of the year. It's called The Vast of Night on Amazon Prime. And it is a really clever, well-done movie that blends in a way I've never seen. It feels like you're kind of watching an old episode of The Outer Limits or Twilight Zone with kind of that endearing 50s quality of Stand By Me.
Okay.
And the whole idea behind this movie is that this small-town radio show host and the local town operator are trying to uncover a strange signal that's being, I guess, picked up on. And it leads them through a very unusual night that's right in the wheelhouse. I don't want to give much away. And try not to watch the trailers, folks, because they're horrible and give away the entire thing. But it's a really well-crafted movie, a great little flick, and it's on Amazon Prime now, Amazon Prime Movies. Honestly, Tim, I'd say out of 5 stars, I would give this a solid 4 stars.
Wow.
Solid 4. And to be honest with you, I can't even tell you why I can't give it 5. There's nothing specifically missing. There's just something. But it's really great for what it is. Maybe it's because it doesn't have the natural star power everybody's looking for in the movie. Maybe that's what I'm missing, is I don't have a Brad Pitt or a Tom Cruise or a Nicole Kidman or Chris Pratt or somebody that it's like you know this person. This really kind of feels like you really are watching, I don't even know how to explain it. You're kind of watching just this really beautifully little encapsulated gem, this time capsule gem of a movie. So I'd recommend all of our viewers The Vast of Night. And that's my movie review for this week. Have you been watching anything good during this 3-month downtime? Any good movies that you want to throw at people right now?
Actually, I powered my way through Space Force the other day, and I absolutely enjoyed it. Fell in love with it.
Now, that's the new series on, what is it, Netflix?
On Netflix with Steve Carell and John Malkovich, yeah.
Right, and this is the series put together by the guy that did, like, The Office. Well, not...
Yeah, it's Steve Carell and Greg Daniels. Yeah, they co-created it, and you think Steve Carell is pretty much the same character in every series, but he's not. He's reinvented himself as a 4-star general, Mike Naird, and he starts out as a 3-star general and thinks he's getting that 4th star and moving on in the Air Force, and gets assigned to the Space Force and kind of takes over a ragtag group. And. And it's the series is inventive. It's funny. It's not The Office in space. If that's what you're expecting, you're going to be sorely disappointed. But it's very, very creative and innovative and extremely funny. In fact,
it is a comedy, though. Right?
It is a comedy. It has its dramatic moments, of course, and it's got its teachable moments, but it's overall it's very funny. It's very funny, and it's got that awkward comedy to it too. much like those moments in The Office. So overall, I give it a 4.75 out of 5 stars. I don't know why it's not absolutely perfect, but I thought it was perfect enough for me. So
cool. Yeah, that's one I haven't gotten to, but I want to check out. All right, so that's your reviews for this week, folks. Speaking of reviews, I'm hoping that by now all of you or a majority of you had a chance to watch the Holzer Files special, the Holzer Files Decrypted, that aired on Travel Channel this past Thursday, and enjoyed it. Next Thursday, I'm back hosting another special with the team from Destination Fear. And I'll be sitting down with Dakota Layden and his sister Chelsea and Tanner, and we're going to talk over some of their favorite moments from their first season of Destination Fear. The following week, I'll be sitting down with Amy Bruni, Adam Berry, and Chip Coffey from Kindred Spirits and reviewing some of their highlights from a really interesting episode. And then the week after that, we wrap up these quarantine specials with the cast of the Ghost Brothers. And I just got done filming that episode the other day. So I've been kind of double dogging it a few times, Tim, where during the day I'm filming specials for Travel Channel, and at night we're filming the Holzer Files. So it's been a lot of work, but a lot of fun. And I'm excited to see what everybody thinks. So email me, let me know what you thought of the Holzer Files Decrypted special that aired this last Thursday, and go set your DVRs so that you don't miss the other specials that are coming up over the next 3 weeks. All right, let's get to it, Tim. We've got an interesting guest and an interesting topic today, something that always seems to capture the attention and imagination of our viewers and listeners around the world. The book is coming out in August. It's called Poltergeist, A New Investigation into Destructive Haunting. And we've got a link up for that book on today's program so people can find it and check it out. Our guest, John Fraser, is currently a member of the Spontaneous Cases Committee and the Council of the Society for Psychical Research. He has previously been vice chair of investigations of the Ghost Club, which was founded in 1862, and joined the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena in its founding year. He is the author of Ghost Hunting, A Survivor's Guide, which came out through History Press back in 2010. And he's written articles for the Fortean Times and other magazines. John lives in the UK, of course. He's here with us today. John, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Poltergeist, why do you think that just that word captures people's attention so much? It can't just be the Steven Spielberg movie series. What about the phenomena and the word really seem to intrigue people to this type of paranormal activity?
I think because ghosts don't do much. They tend to appear, disappear. If you're lucky, occasionally walk through walls. But poltergeists are very interactive. They throw things around, create pools of water, occasionally small fires. And if you're looking at things that appeal to people, they're very much people's worst nightmare of the paranormal.
It's interesting that you say create pools of water, because I can't say at this point where I just finished filming, John, but for one of the episodes of the Holzer Files, I had brought a few different changes of shirts in because it was very hot. I wanted to have some extra clothes on hand and see which outfit they wanted me to wear. And I brought the clothes from my hotel, perfectly dry, clean. They've been hanging up in my closet for 2 weeks here in the hotel I'm in. I laid them on the table. And when they chose the outfit, I went over and grabbed it and put it on. The shirt was soaking wet. And nothing else on the table was. The table wasn't wet. The tablecloth wasn't wet. The clothes next to it, on top of it, and below it were not wet. But the shirt that they picked out, soaking wet. And I thought, oh, is this some kind of joke? And they were like, no, we're just seeing this clothes for the first time, Dave. We just walked in. So I can't explain what happened. And again, I can't explain how the other clothes weren't affected. But the shirt was soaking wet. This water aspect of it, what can you tell us about that? And then we'll kind of backpedal, but I am fascinated about that while we're mentioning it.
Well, I think of poltergeist as being, well, it's a syndrome. It's lots of evidential bits and pieces. I mean, as to whether why water suddenly appears. If I knew that, we'd probably have solved the riddle. But there's a number of cases. Enfield Poltergeist being perhaps the most famous one this side of the Atlantic, especially as a preliminary to other things happening, suddenly pools of water appear in the Valora, or occasionally on the ceiling, dripping from the ceiling even. But over and above that, we can only look at it as a symptom. If we'd solved the riddle, we'd probably know what poltergeists were. And anyone who is 100% sure is probably just speculating.
Well, John, has there ever been testing of the water? I mean, we investigated a case, the Lottie Peck house, where the family would have water just start pouring in, like it was raining inside a room. And they would have plumbers and specialists come out who could find no excuse for it. There were no sweaty pipes. There were no broken pipes. Nothing ruptured, no damage. But this water would just rain down in a room for a time. But I'm curious, has anybody ever actually tested the water? And if so, has there been any indication to it being more than just water?
To the best of my knowledge, no, that hasn't happened. It probably should. It's really a question of getting, you tend to, if you're doing an investigation, you might tend to have a psychologist. You might tend to have somebody skilled in electronics. But you just don't tend to have a water expert handy, the exception possibly being taps. The plumbers who probably would have that if they came across one. But no, it's just a question of having somebody there on the spot. And to the best of my knowledge, that's never happened yet, but it would be a fascinating experiment.
Wow, so folks, if you encounter this phenomena in your home, gather up the moisture any way you can without trying to soak it up with something and squeezing it into a jar. Try to collect it so that you're keeping as many elements out. The reason I say you don't want to take a rag and do it is because anything that's on the rag may also be transferred, which is tainting it. But if you can collect the moisture itself, jar it up and get it tested somehow, contact us. I'll see if there's somebody I can help put you in touch with that can actually test this. I've just got to be curious. I mean, is this a form of ectoplasm? What exactly are we experiencing, and how is it there 1 minute, gone the next? Let's dig in a little bit deeper. There seems to be many different kind of explanations or definitions for what a poltergeist is. What in your catalog here, what exactly is a poltergeist? Is it a ghost, a grouping of ghosts, or some other phenomena altogether?
Well, the first interesting thing is when you look at ghost phenomena, when you take away the sort of legendary ghosts that probably never existed and never will exist, but make a good ghost story, and actually look at the hardcore recent sightings, you have almost always got a poltergeist element that goes with it. The two are very connected. And I mean, when you start to think about it, I mean, I'm actually drinking coffee here out of a mug which has lots of penguins on it, and ultimately, you know, you've got the emperor penguin, the king penguin, and what have you. Ultimately, they're just penguins. And when you start to think of it, we're categorizing lots of different paranormal phenomena: ghosts, poltergeist, mediumistic ability. And as I kind of researched this book, I started to see that there was a absolutely massive overlap. And whatever we're talking about is possibly just one type of phenomena. There was a survey done in the 1970s books by some researchers called Gold and Cannell that basically showed that at least 30% of poltergeist cases had haunting, had apparitions, and about another 30% had audio ghostly phenomena. So I think the two are one and the same.
Do you think that one feeds the other, this chaotic energy of whatever a poltergeist might be, maybe not necessarily a spirit in nature, but an energy discharge, is enough to work as a battery so that spirits or ghosts are able to be seen because of that energetic transfer?
a lot of people would think that, and that's definitely a possibility. I tend to turn it on its head. I mean, the thing about poltergeists and to be honest, ghosts, is they don't really do much that makes much sense at all. Poltergeist threw a few things around. There was a case, the Andover case, where by rapping it predicted the soccer results and without much accuracy for the next weekend. I mean, they kind of behave like spoiled children. I tend to think that on the balance of evidence, at least, they're far more likely to be powers within us than an outside entity. I mean, if I was a self-respecting, you know, afterlife ghost, I mean, would you really do half the things that you find in the average poltergeist case, just randomly throwing things around, creating pools of water for that matter, and when any communication's got, nothing of any real meaning at all. So I tend to, I mean, I suspect 99% of spiritualists would disagree with me, but I tend to think we might be looking for something within us.
It's interesting because if this energy is manifesting in a way, and so many paranormal investigations are trying to collect data like barometric pressure and temperature, different things like that. If in these cases where there is an intense power, like you said, a haunting is usually this kind of ghost that's there 1 minute, gone the next, doesn't really do anything of any import. But when a poltergeist is taking place, this type of activity, there seems to be a much more prominent kind of release of force, whether it's coming from us, the humans, or some other spiritual element. I wonder if that is what's causing elemental changes like water, when you've got certain, you know, the heat, the humidity, the cool things coming together in one, and people talk about cold spots of spirits, and you know, is that creating basically this interior rainstorm because of these different temperature changes and doing it so quickly and radically that it's creating these pools of water?
I think that would probably be a fairly logical deduction, because yes, I mean, I don't think any, the water is probably more of a byproduct. And as for what causes it, I mean, there's a particular interesting case that I mentioned in Poltergeist. Let's call it Poltergeist in Your Investigation, because the whole title goes on for about ever. A church, an old church in Essex, England, Langenhoe Church, which had both ghostly and poltergeist phenomena, and just happened to be at the epicenter of England's last major earthquake in the late 19th century, and is basically on a fault line. So there must be all kinds of possible geomagnetic and forces working there. And I mean, there seems to be when you look at cases, there seems to be a trigger of possible emotional energy. Maybe somebody's had a recent bereavement, or somebody's lost a job, or even somebody's just moved house, which, if you look at it, is probably one of the most stressful things you do. And possibly environmental effects as well, which kind of create an amazing cocktail, which could trigger all kinds of interesting things off.
What if you know, if this activity is taking place and it's got these powerful byproducts, things moving, leaving moisture, doing this, why are we not able to effectively diagnose the type of energy? You know, is it geothermal? Is it nuclear? Is it electromagnetic? You know, some seem to indicate that that's more of the electromagnetic aspects, but there are other times when the you know, EMF field readers and things like that don't ping at all, but crazy activities going on. Why do you think scientifically we cannot limit it to one type of energy expulsion?
Probably because we haven't got enough hardcore scientists involved. I mean, our side of the Atlantic, we've got about 8 universities that would admit to having some kind of parapsychology department, although they do call it, they sometimes disguise it with calling it anomalistic psychology. That's just the psychologists. I mean, we have very few hardcore physicists actually involved. So certainly our side of the Atlantic, we're relying on volunteers grabbing what expertise they can. Are things then really any different your side of the Atlantic? I mean, I know you've got Duke University and what have you, but I think you've probably got the same problem.
And that's what it seems. And that's what's so frustrating to me. And I think so many people that are fascinated by this field is that there doesn't seem to be one universal knowledge about this. You know, I mean, we believe that, you know, or at least this has been propagated for years, right? There's always going to be this one poltergeist agent that it seems to center around. The theory is longstanding that it's usually a prepubescent teenage girl about to hit puberty. But we've seen that it actually has happened in menopausal women, men's lives, boys' lives. There doesn't seem to be a hard and fast rule to any of this and why or how it takes place.
I think there is and there isn't. I mean, I think looking at the menopausal girl was far too simplistic. But in nearly every case, there is some kind of trigger. As you say, it could be the menopause for that matter, although I haven't come across that many cases myself. But usually when you look back, something has happened that has triggered the phenomena off, some change of life, some, as I say, moving house is a particularly good one. And then you get the story of moving into a haunted house when you've possibly created it yourself by moving in the first place. I think people should be looking for a traumatic, in inverted commas, experience, but not looking for any particular one experience. And that's possibly where we went wrong with the just looking at young adolescents. Although that probably is a major trigger. I remember many years ago when I was an adolescent, it was quite a traumatic time, you know.
Yeah, it certainly was. I may be, 40 years removed from that 12-year-old boy, but that start into that life is very traumatic in many different ways and overly dramatic. Let's reeling it back again with poltergeist phenomena. What are some of the key elements we look for to denote that this is in fact under that umbrella of poltergeist?
Well, there's the obvious ones, obviously. Stone throwing is very prominent. Object movement. One that hasn't really been accepted, but which I mentioned in the book, is a bit of research that's done by a colleague of mine in the SPR, Mary Rose Barrington, who sadly passed on recently. Categorizing these interesting things that she terms as jots, which is a anagram of just one of those things. Now, I think most people have kind of maybe put down an object and then never been able to find it, or found it in a ridiculous place, or. Right. I can tell that's happened to you from your reaction probably, or even found it back in the same place after looking in the same place millions of times before, and that is actually one of the first signs of minor poltergeist activity. A lot of bigger poltergeist cases have actually started with this type of jots. So we start to get the amazing theory that poltergeist energy might actually be a lot more common than we think it is. That most of the stuff doesn't develop to the stones throwing and objects being thrown around and so on. But there might be that minor undercurrent. So next time you or any of your listeners can't find an object and then find it on top of the wardrobe when they left it downstairs in the kitchen drawer or something, it might make you think. It might just be it's an energy that's working in small ways most of the time, but then kind of goes on a great big jamboree of major occurrences.
John, I've got a weird question. I'll take you down the rabbit hole for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, there's a lot of talk of this holographic universe, the concept that we really are living in a matrix style life or existence. Has there been any research that you're aware of looking at this phenomena from that aspect? Because, you know, if we are in this kind of holographic version of reality, that might explain some of these glitches of setting something down and it disappearing, reappearing there later, or appearing in other strange places. And again, I don't know how much stock I give in that, but there are people that have spent a lot of time researching that could make pretty compelling arguments for the high strangeness of all of it. And I just wondered if you've seen anything where these two theories kind of butt up against each other and may actually complement each other better than we would expect.
I don't know anyone, to be honest, that's pushing that particular theory at the moment. It tends to be a good-natured battle between afterlife powers and powers within us. Didn't discount it, obviously, but I would tend to call on Occam's razor on that one. You know, the old adage that the simpler the theory, the more the simpler the theory is, the more acceptable it is, at least to be right, looked at in the first place. And
but Occam's razor also, on the other side, could be said that that's just a lazy man's way out of answering a question. And I'm not putting that on you. I'm just saying, overall, Occam's razor always seems to be like, when it's that perfect example for a parent, when you ask a parent a question they have no answer for, it doesn't matter. It's because I'm your dad. That's why. That's always seemed like Occam's razor. Yeah, sometimes the simplest is the truest experience. But, or is it just that nobody's put that thought in to take these things a little bit further?
This is true. This is true to some extent. But I think good old William of Ockham in the 10th century did have a point. I mean, if you see rain, you can hypothesize that, you know, maybe somebody's God is crying or something like that. Come out with all kinds of theories which aren't logically falsifiable, but it's far more simple just to accept that, you know, clouds hold water. And eventually the water comes downwards. I think there is a certain amount of justification if you're coming out with a multi-layered theory about a multi-dimensional matrixed universe. You do have to build some foundations for that theory, because it's quite possible to make a theory that can't be disproved. But it's a lot, I think, more sensible to at least take what we've got and then maybe build a theory that's one stage out of what we've got.
Why are there so many ghost hunters, but you really don't hear people that specialize just in poltergeist activity?
That's a good question. Chapter 3 in my book, I think. Probably because people think that poltergeist activity is very rare. Well, that's probably the main one. And I try to claim that it's anything but rare. I mean, I gave you the example of the jots. It's also quite interesting that when you kind of think poltergeists, they happen in America, they happen in England, Scotland, and what have you, but there doesn't seem to be much of a culture of poltergeists in the rest of the world. I wonder why that is. But if you go to places like Transylvania, which I think you might have been to, actually. I've been to.
I've been there three times now.
I've been six.
Oh, I'll catch you eventually.
But we're not in competition. No, actually went with the Ghost Club just after turning the millennium to the people that basically invented Dracula tourism, the Romanians, but they were also very interested in the subject and very interested in sort of the paranormal and parapsychology as well. And the more I looked at this, a lot of cases that are described in Romania as being vampire ones, actually, when you actually look at what's happened, take away the mythology we have with the guy in the black cloak, which was never Romanian anyway, you kind of get incidents of stone throwing, lots of noises, crashes and bangs. And then when you take away the cultural differences, what are you left with? A poltergeist, quite possibly. And when you actually look at that, if you go to Latin America in Colombia, there's lots of cases involving what they call the mythological duende, which is basically translated as a goblin. Now, probably why these cases haven't been investigated is, I mean, ghost hunting is kind of reasonably cool and acceptable and, you know, lots of programs on it and people kind of take it quite seriously. But, you know, goblin hunting, you know, I mean, that's the strangest of the strange. So they're all neglected. But when you actually start,
you know, that Tim is picking on our weekend events, goblin hunting.
I know
when you can catch them, John.
But when you actually look at what these goblins do, they tend to throw stones, make lots of noises, and possibly throw other things around as well. So you've kind of got the case that whilst we think poltergeists are there, they're probably a lot more common than we imagine. But that's probably one of the main reasons that people haven't really tried to look into them. The other really good reason is because they happen to people, you have to do it very, very carefully anyway. You don't want to rush in. The worst thing you can do is take one of these people that call themselves a demonologist and frighten the life out of people that are already pretty frightened by what's happening. And if it is nervous energy, possibly trigger some other phenomena. So you have to, it's something you probably want to learn about before doing, but which is, again, it's a lot easier to spend the night in an old house that's open to the public than it is to suddenly go into a spontaneous case in somebody's home. So I think that's probably why it's been neglected, but it shouldn't be.
I agree. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Darkness Radio.
June is Pride Month, and while this year's celebrations may be a little different than usual, there are still ways that we can come together to support the LGBTQ community. One way is with Bombas' new Pride collection. These colorful socks bring more love, compassion, and comfort into the world because these socks give back to those experiencing homelessness in the LGBTQ plus community. You know, I got a few pair of these socks celebrating Pride Month myself, and I love the colors. I love the fact that these socks stand out on their own, and I've been getting compliments left and right about these socks. I've been wearing them around town. I wore them with me to the clinic, to the foot doctor the other day. I wore them with me to the pharmacy. I've been wearing them, and people have been saying, oh my God, I love your socks. Where have you been getting them? And I tell them I got them from Bombas. And then I tell them about Bombas' mission during Pride Month and where the money's been going to the homeless community and the LGBTQ plus community and what Bombas is doing with that community. And people, they want the information. They want to know how they can get in on the action and help out the homeless community and the LGBTQ community. So I tell them what they can do. And people get excited about it. They get excited about wanting to be philanthropic with the community, which is great. We're seeing a change, folks. We're seeing a change in people wanting to come together and help their fellow man. And that's what's really great about Bombas and what I love about Bombas and what I love about Bombas being a sponsor of Beyond the Darkness. And this month is a really great month. And I love Bombas's mission this month. And you know, what's great about Bombas this month is for every pair of Pride socks that you buy, Bombas is going to go ahead and donate a pair to someone in need in the LGBTQ community through the Ally Coalition, which is absolutely wonderful. Bombas works year-round with the Ally Coalition, an organization that uses music to illuminate the systemic inequalities facing the LGBTQ community, like homelessness. And did you know that the LGBTQ community is more at risk of experiencing homelessness? 1 in 10 young adults in the LGBTQ plus community will experience it. That according to a study by the Voices of Youth Count. The Bombas Pride collection comes in 6 colorful styles, and I want you to check them out because they're all absolutely wonderful styles. I tell you, I have a pair that have, they're kind of like an orange creamsicle color. They're like mid-calf, and I absolutely love them. I've been wearing them around town, and they're also, I have a like a golf sock that they have kind of a nice little brick pattern around the toe. Those are nice and comfortable too. I've been wearing both of those around town, and I've been getting amazing compliments on both those socks. And I want you to go check them out. I want you to go check out the different styles this month that are supporting Pride Month, because these socks are nice, they stand out, and of course, they keep you warm when you need your foot warm. They keep them cool when you need them cool. Bombas socks always perform in the clutch. Bombas socks are made with extra long staple cotton. They're the softest, most breathable cotton in the world, and they're built with a cushioned footbed that creates a layer of comfort between you and your shoes without adding any bulk, which is important because, hey, we're in the middle of June. It's going to get hot outside, you know? Bombas socks provide support in places that you didn't even know you needed it, like your arches. When you put on a Bombas sock, it just kind of grabs that arch and it supports it. It feels real nice. Each sock is built with a special arch-hugging system that's supportive, but it's not too tight. It feels just right. It's like a nice little hug for your foot. You ever notice that annoying toe seam that most socks have? That one that it just kind of gets there and it's kind of hurting your foot. Well, Bombas has gotten rid of it. It's gone. It's just smooth sailing all the way across the top of your foot. Now, Pride is usually a time where we can all come together, but because many Pride events were canceled this year, it's more important than ever to find new ways to show support and give back to the community. So here's what you can do. Get in with us right now. Help out the LGBTQ plus community. Help out homelessness in the LGBTQ plus community. Join your buddies here at Beyond the Darkness. Go to bombas.com/darkness today to shop the Pride collection and get 20% off your first order. That's bombas.com/darkness. Get 20% off your first order and shop the Pride collection. One more time, bombas.com/darkness. Do it today.
Hey, hey, hey. This is NFL Hall of Famer Ray Lewis. I'm excited to announce the launch of my new podcast, Everyday Greatness, the Ray Lewis Podcast. I'll be talking with friends, family members, old teammates, athletes, celebrities, moguls. And guess what? I'll be talking to you. Listen, this is all in the search for everyday greatness. So I'm asking you to come along with me on this ride. Download new episodes of Everyday Greatness, the Ray Lewis Podcast, every Friday on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on PodcastOne.com. It's not what you have, it's what's inside of you that actually inspires greatness.
John Fraser, our guest, as we're discussing his book, Poltergeist, A New Investigation into Destructive Haunting. And we're just kind of fleshing out some of the different aspects of this phenomena, why it is so prevalent in specific areas and not in others. But like you said, you made a great point. It is, but it's just been given different names in a lot of different cultures. They're not thinking of it as the knocking ghost or the noisy goat. They're thinking of it as a goblin, or they're thinking of it as elementals or the ancestors or whatever they've attributed the title to explain away the exact type of phenomena that is surrounding poltergeist activity. John, what are like the issues in in getting into an investigation, is it quite different investigating a full-on poltergeist case as it is to well-known hauntings?
I'd say probably not, but I would say that because I'm trying to make the argument that both are probably one and the same, different types of phenomena of the same power. I think where we possibly go wrong with investigating hauntings is we investigate an awful lot of places that aren't haunted. In the sense that I can give you a very quick, funny story. I mean, there's this old creepy house called Icktham Moat that comes up on all the ghost books in the UK and Kent, where a lady, Dame Dorothy Selby, was supposed to have been picked up. And I think a skeleton was actually found there. But a little bit of research. Good old Dame Dorothy Selby wasn't picked up there. She was actually buried down the road in the local church. There's a big mausoleum. So you kind of get so many romantic cases of ghosts and people, to be honest, wanting to let their haunted castles and haunted inns and haunted old houses out for investigations. I think there's enough a lot of ghost hunting is actually probably done in not very haunted places. Now, take away them and take away the cases where recent stuff's happened, and the approach should be the same, but there needs to be two types of approaches. One where it's an open area where nobody lives and you can just investigate, and the other where somebody lives there, where the client, if you like, has to come first and given suitable reassurances and obviously respect paid to the fact that you're on somebody else's premises. Over and above that, no, I think that, as I say, as I'm making the big claim that they are actually one and the same thing, they should be approached in the same way.
Do you feel, though, that there's a different ethical component to investigating poltergeist cases? Now, I know that you say that you're kind of making the case that hauntings and poltergeist cases are one and the same. But, you know, a castle that's 200 years old can be haunted without something that seems to be integral to the type of haunting that's taking place. The poltergeist case seems to be surrounding more of an individual or individuals that may be more key to the element of what's actually taking place. How do you go about investigating the person ethically and respectfully to get the best definitive information that we can from them, but not intruding, or being intrusive into too much of their personal world?
Well, I mean, you have to ask some questions about what's happened in the past, their experiences in the past, and whether there's been any sort of trigger the phenomena. Over and above that, though, no, you do not want to be totally intrusive. I mean, there was a case in the 1930s, which is actually only about 300 yards from where I live, called the Thornton Heath Poltergeist, where a chap called Nando Fodor, who was a paranormal investigator, but also a follower of Freud and had this particular slant, actually had the poltergeist victim into his offices and was strip searching her and giving her x-rays to check she wasn't holding anything that was being thrown and what have you. And no, that you can't do that. That's absolutely unethical, absolutely beyond the bounds. The person has to come first, and it has to be a exercise in reassurance as much as anything else. So to a certain extent, you can only investigate the person so far. But what you can do, of course, is investigate if there's any phenomena happening with their permission, and obviously look for similarities between one case and the next.
How important is it to get to the bottom, though, of the psychology of the victim or the client, you know, to understand, should we be asking questions regarding psychological issues, medications that they may be on, or does that run into the ethical issues that, you know, would.
No, I think it's quite acceptable to ask questions. What it's not acceptable to do is to make answers public where it was previously arranged not to. I mean, there's quite a famous case, I think the Vossenheim case in Germany, that where they discovered a trigger was a breakup of a relationship with a young lady who worked in a law office. That was obviously interesting. I hope she gave permission for all that information to go public, because it did. No, there's nothing wrong with asking. What you have to do is find out the parameters of anything that actually gets reported is within the interest of the person. I mean, obviously, there's some cases you'd need to anonymize. I investigated some years back about, there was a young single mother in a haunted, in a house with apparitional and poltergeist activity. She'd just been upgraded from a one-bed social house to a two-bed social house. So there was no reason for her to, you know, be unhappy with living there. She was quite excited with living there. And I mean, to be honest, I talk about it anecdotally without obviously giving the place or anything like that. To be honest, the best thing we managed to do for her in the end, apart from identifying some, you know, interesting phenomena, was we actually managed, with a bit of help from her Member of Parliament, to lobby the social housing organisation and get her transferred to an exactly same house just across the street. So there are ways in which you can possibly alleviate the situation, but you have to be very careful that you don't go public and stuff. But you can ask questions. I mean, people are grown-ups. If you're dealing with grown-ups, that is, people are quite entitled to say, I don't want to answer that or anything like that. But most people that have poltergeist want to try and find out if something has triggered it. So they're quite happy to talk about their background and whether they've experienced anything in the past or whether...
Are you finding a commonality in that then? Is there, as some have put forth, that maybe people that are prone to seizures are more prevalent in the field of poltergeist activity? Are you finding anything that corroborates some of those theories?
I haven't come across many poltergeists where there's been epileptics in the house, to be honest. It seems to be more a life event than a particular medical condition. Either that or an event surrounding the premises that would kind of trigger people into a state of heightened expectation. I mean, I do actually make a claim in the book that the wonderful, controversial Amityville Horror could actually have just been a minor poltergeist activity. I mean, when you actually look at what happened there and take away all the froth and films, there was a few object movements. There was people going into the house of a murder victims, which is plenty of stress. There was people overextending in the mortgage. When you take away the froth, the footprints in the snow, which could have been anything, the devil appeared in suit at the back of a fireplace, which is obvious pareidolia. You're kind of left with a few interesting possible poltergeist incidents. So I'd say it's more life situations and medical conditions, though I certainly couldn't discount the latter. I just haven't come across that many myself.
What would you say is one of the most impressive displays of poltergeist activity that you've been witness to firsthand?
Oh, wow. If I was so lucky. I more categorize myself. I mean, I've done a lot of spending the night in places in my time, but I more categorize myself as a paranormal researcher these days. I'm also lucky or unlucky enough to be about as psychic as the average brick. The best I've ever happened is a door possibly opening of its own accord, and a haunted Lincoln bomber in RAF Cosworth in Cambridgeshire, UK. I didn't actually see it happen. It wasn't open, and then it was open, and there was nobody around at the time. So that's probably the best I've got, unfortunately. I tend to research other people's experience and hope that something happens to me, but it rarely does.
We'll take our final break. We'll come back. We've got more to discuss right here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio.
Every day and in every way, I'm getting better and better, and I hope you are too. You know, I've been getting more and more emails from you talking about how you're feeling better because you've been using Feels. Hey, it's your boy Timmy, and I want to talk to you for just a moment about Feels CBD. You know, I've been going through a lot of pain for a lot of years, some sleeplessness because of that pain, and I've been going through some anxiety because of that pain, but it's been getting better because I've been using Feels. And a lot of you have been emailing me over the last month or two telling me that you're getting better now because you've been using Feels. Although I know there's still a few of you who are emailing me saying, I don't know, Tim, really? You tell me you turned your mom onto it and she's feeling better, and I still don't know if I believe you or not. Believe it. Believe it. I'm telling you, more and more people are getting a hold of me and saying, you know what, Tim, I tried it and it works. What was there to doubt? Do you think I was steering you wrong? If I tell you I'm using it, I'm using it. I am using it. Now, a lot of you are asking me, well, Tim, how much should you use? How much should I use? You know what? The only thing I can tell you is go to the people at Feels and ask them. Ask them. Although I know what works for me, I don't necessarily know what works for you because I don't know your history. But the people at Feels are real great about sitting down with you and telling you what exactly it is you need. That's why they're there. Now, you may be saying to yourself, self, what is Feels? Well, if you experience stress, if you have anxiety, chronic pain, trouble sleeping at least once a week, you aren't alone. A lot of us do. Me personally, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Everything hurts except for the tip of the pinky on my left hand. That's it. Everything else is herniated or bulging or broken, or you know my history by now. But I needed some help along the way, and the good people at Feels came along and they said, Tim, we want to help. Thank you. Thank you, Feels. I appreciate it. Feels is premium CBD delivered directly to your doorstep. You don't have to go anywhere. And in this society, in this day and age where there's pandemics, and by gosh, you probably should stay in the house anyways, it's great that Feels comes directly to you. Feels naturally helps you reduce stress, anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness. And I'll tell you, without my Feels, I don't sleep at all. Maybe an hour, hour and a half tops, and I'm back up again. And I hurt. And I've got anxiety because I hurt. But with Feels, I sleep through the night. I sleep like a baby. I take two droppers a day. I take a dropper before I go to bed. I take a dropper full when I get up. And with that, I'm able to sit here and do this podcast and tape this podcast. And with that, I'm able to get through my day and get through my business. And I'm able to sleep at night. And I'm able to manage with all that chronic pain. And there's a lot to be there. Boy, I'll tell you, I could sit down a big, thick manila folder full of MRIs and x-rays and a life history full of pain and injuries. But Feels helps me manage all of that. It can help you manage too. It's real easy to take. You just place a few drops of Feels under your tongue and feel the difference within minutes. The thing to remember about CBD, though, is that finding the right dose is important. And everyone's dose is different. Mine is different than what yours is going to be. Leave some room to experiment there over the course of about a week or so. You may need to take more or less depending on what effects you're getting. Like I said, for me, it's a couple of droppers full a day. It may be more or less for you. What's great about Feels, like I told you, if you're new to CBD, Feels offers a free CBD hotline to help guide you through your personal experience. It's not just dropping it off at your doorstep and then good luck to you. Nope, Feels is there with you all the way through. You have questions, you call them, they answer. They're right there every step of the way, and that's why I love Feels. Feel better naturally. There's no high, there's no hangover, there's no addiction, there's no kicking it off your back, there's no shakes, there's no feeling icky once you've come down off of it. It's like taking ibuprofen. It's perfect. It's just the perfect way to get rid of that pain, that anxiety, that sleeplessness. It's perfect. It helps bring down that anxiety as well. Get in on the deal. Join the Feels community and get Feels delivered to your door every single month. And you'll save money on every single order. And of course, you can pause or cancel at any time. But once you start feeling great with Feels, I don't know why you'd want to stop. I honestly don't. How do you get in on the deal? It's real simple. Feels has me feeling my best every day. It can help you too. And get started today if you haven't already. I don't know why you haven't. Become a member today by going to feels.com/darkness. We're going to give you 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's feals.com/darkness. Become a member. Get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. One more time. feals.com/darkness. Get rid of that anxiety. Get rid of that pain. Start sleeping. You deserve it. You're worth it. Stop suffering. You don't have to suffer. You think you do. You think that some penance you need to pay. You don't. Get that monkey off your back. Start living. Get a hold of Feels today. feals.com/darkness. 50% off, automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. Feels.com/darkness. Do it today.
We're back with the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. That guy over there, Tim Dennis, and our guest today, John Frazier, as we're discussing poltergeists, a new investigation into destructive haunting. How does poltergeist activity differ at all with mediums? And do you give stock to mediums in investigations for paranormal activity to begin with?
As a rule, I don't. I don't tend to use mediums in my research at the moment. I have done in the past. I certainly think it's an interesting experiment to take a medium into a lesser known premises to see what they can pick up, because it's an open experiment. If they don't know the background and they find something out about the background, it's very impressive. Going back to that case of the single mother in the social housing, we did actually take two mediums in there, and they did actually identify the kind of areas where the entity was the entity had been reported as standing, and the sex and approximate age of the entity. As it had been told to myself by the lady in question, but not to them. That could have been ESP, but still, that's quite impressive anyway. I think, especially when it comes down to physical mediums, there is undoubtedly an overlap. You've got the likes of Matthew Manning, who's now a world-renowned medium, who started out as a boy whose poltergeist incidents used to follow him around so much he nearly got expelled from school. And then when you actually think about that, I mean, there's got to be some kind of overlap. I'd make a claim that it's the difference between spontaneous psychokinesis and unspontaneous psychokinesis, you know, controlled psychokinesis, although I suspect most mediums would disagree with me.
But talk us a little bit about that case. I mean, that's fascinating. So much activity took place around this kid. He almost gets expelled from school.
Oh, Matthew Manning, yeah, he's, he started at, it started out with a couple of poltergeist incidents in the family home. A ornamental vase kept appearing on the floor every day, and the father started putting talcum powder down in case anyone was having jokes. And now it still appeared, and it it's quite clear it was actually had jumped and went flat down on the floor because there wasn't any dragging movements or anything like that, let alone footprints. Then it went away for a year or two, came back again in his new house, and then he went to boarding school, and there was a lot of object movements in his boarding school. And yes, at one time the headmaster had to be talked out of expelling him. But then as he gradually got through puberty, he started to certainly pick up the fact he had some kind of psychic powers, and he started channeling them, doing automatic writing. Actually wrote a best-selling book at the age of 21. It's still around today. And it's still, I think he's more into healing at the moment. So you've actually got a gentleman who has went through the whole spectrum, in effect, of paranormal activity, from poltergeist activity to automatic writing to being a medium to being a healer. And I think, why look for one, lots of little boxes? I think you've probably got one big box. I made that sort of fun penguin analogy earlier, but you can start trying to subdivide them into species, but they're all just penguins in the end. I think paranormal phenomena is probably just one particular type of power that we don't fully understand yet.
Do you believe that most of us have had some form of poltergeist activity take place around us?
I think it's quite possible, and certainly if we accept that jots could be poltergeist activity. I mean, I've certainly had a few. I lost a very expensive textbook once in the lining of my my bag just before some exams, and in one of the side pockets of my bag just before exams, and I actually borrowed it from a national library and probably would have had to have paid a vast amount of money. And after looking countless times, I found it in exactly the same place where I sure I had left it. So, I mean, I kind of shrugged my shoulders and said, well, that was just one of those things. That's why it's a very good terminology. But I can't explain that. You know, it's not difficult to look in the side pocket of a bag. It's either there or it isn't there. So yes, it's quite possible we've all had low-level poltergeist activity, or at least the vast majority of us.
What are some of the other cases that you examine in this book? You know, I know our listeners are always fascinated by the actual cases themselves.
Well, the subtitle of the book, the title's far too long, of course, Poltergeist, New Investigation into Destructive Haunting, including The Gage Witch's Prison, St. Joseph's. Now, the reason I included that is because...
The Cage?
The Cage Witch's Prison, St. Joseph's, Essex.
Okay. Right. I think we actually did an episode or a short bit on an episode about that in the past, but for listeners that don't know about that, please catch us up.
Yeah, sure. I know one of my colleagues stateside, Richard Estep's, written a book about it, so it could have been picked up by that. Cage is an old hole. It's actually just a quite a small house these days, but it used to be an old holding cell for drunks and what have you in Victorian times, and it was converted into a house basically. And there's this interesting old plaque on it which claims which wasn't put by the current owners. It's been there ever since it was converted. The claims that it goes back to 1582 archaeology probably doesn't support that, and may have had a witch in it called Ursula Kemp, who indeed was kept somewhere in St. Joseph's before being taken to be hanged at Chelmsford. So all that's kind of true, may not have been the cage. But nevertheless, you've got some wonderful, interesting events surrounding it, and you've got heightened expectation before you start. So a lady called Vanessa Mitchell moves in to the cage, initially with some friends who are her lodgers. She gets pushed and shoved by unseen forces. Other things happen to our lodgers as well. One or two apparitions. All of them see a cooked can fly across the table. Various other things. Then the lodgers moves out and it gets worse. She starts seeing some other apparitions. Doors slamming and banging. All kinds of things, and eventually has to leave the house. Tries to let it out to other people, but they don't stay long. At which point she had a house. She couldn't do anything with. She was living in a caravan at one point. She did let it out for paranormal investigators. Now, the reason I mean, this is a good poltergeist case, or a good ghost case as well, for that matter. But the reason I feature it in the book is because Vanessa kindly gave me permission to basically interview all of the witnesses and also track down some paranormal teams that had been there. So I basically rented a caravan quite near St. Joseph's and basically had over the course of a weekend, had quite a few witnesses coming down and then basically tracked down the paranormal investigators. And there was a very good similarity of what people had experienced. There was no less than 5 cases of poltergeist scratchings or bruisings, which is another symptom that we haven't mentioned yet. There was 2 particular doors that kept on slamming, although they weren't necessarily common knowledge, because the whole publicity of this place had been about haunted witches and what have you. The sort of interesting day-to-day stuff had never been really, really recorded at the time. So we kind of got to the fact that, you know, if enough people see and hear the same thing, they have no connection with each other. I mean, in a court of law, that would be seen as collective witness testimony, and if it can prove a case in the court of law, why can't it prove a case in the paranormal?
The overall on this, when you see a haunting that's this active and you know, all of these claims go on and there are so many witnesses to them, is there ever a turnoff to these phenomena? Does it all of a sudden just stop, or do we watch it slowly wane? What can you tell us regarding that aspect?
I don't know if you're aware of a case stateside, which is nicknamed the Black Monk of Pontefract.
Yes.
You are, great. I think Richard De Steps written another book about that as There you go, Richard.
You're getting behind. John Richard's writing them all. You got to get to it.
Oh, well, Black Monk of Pontefract, chapter 7. Chapter 9. St. Joseph's is chapter 7. So there we go, a bit of friendly competition. But the reason Black Monk of Pontefract is so interesting is not because it's a black monk. There's absolutely no chance a average council house in Pontefract was haunted by a black monk. Absolutely no evidence for it at all. I spent a whole weekend up in the archives of Pontefract Museum and Library, basically just finding that out. As a side twist, that shows how we always want to identify our friendly but anonymous poltergeist with something, be they vampires, be they dead people, or be they black monks. But the interesting thing about Black Monk is most of the phenomena happened between 1966 and 1968. It was quite intense. A young girl may possibly have been dragged up the stairs by her hair, but then it kind of went quiet until they made a movie about it. And the guy that made the movie bought the house and started experiencing lots of strange things, and he wasn't the only one either. So, I mean, we've either got a theory, I mean, you know, putting aside fraud, and there's no evidence for that, but there's always a possibility. But we've either got a theory that there was a black monk. He sort of thought he'd take a 35-year vest and pop his head up again. Or heightened expectation of something, talking it up, can actually cause something to happen itself. I mean, there's another famous case in Canada of a poltergeist called the Philip case, where a group in Canada actually talked up a ghost that they'd purely made up, kept imagining it, kept picturing it, writing stories about it, drawing pictures of it, and then they started to have poltergeist activity. So I actually think there can be gaps, but it's when something happens again, when people's expectations are suddenly heightened, it can trigger the whole thing off. That's why they're not necessarily people-centered. They're not necessarily place-centered. They're a combination of, it's a bit like baking a cake. You throw all the right combinations together and suddenly you've got something happening.
What do you make of the case in Enfield? That was certainly very well known, very well documented. And although there does seem to be some aspects that seem to be fraudulent, there is quite a bit more that is completely anomalous and defies any real form of explanation.
Well, I mean, Enfield was investigated by Maurice Gross and Guy Playfair, who sadly passed away now, but they were members of the SPR, and I actually knew them reasonably well. They were very fine, honest gentlemen for sure. Enfield, yes, there's too many witnesses to simply say it was all fraud. It's also the thorn in my side, because taken at face value, it's about one of very, very few poltergeist cases where there did seem to be some intelligent communications going on. The main victim of the poltergeist, who was a 12-year-old adolescent, so it does happen, Janet, started through automatic talking, identifying who the poltergeist was, a guy called Bill, and on research, and there's no reason she should have known this, they actually found out the exact place where he died, which was the place that Janet had, the voice through Janet had identified, the cemetery he was buried in and what he died of. Now, taken at face value, that ruins my theory. But thankfully, one of my colleagues has just transcribed all 150 hours of the Enfield poltergeist tape. So I might have a little bit of interesting bedroom reading or bedroom listening at some point.
Do you think, though, that in listening to the original recordings and the things that were taking place there, could this evoke activity around you?
Ooh, that's...
Are you hoping so?
That's a theory. I think if I was sitting here listening to the Enfield tapes, after just speaking to you and you putting the idea in my head, it wouldn't be impossible. It would be a bit like the Philip experiment where you're thinking, watching the tape go round and round and suddenly getting to a heightened expectation state. I think if you thought it might, it would. Does that make sense?
It does, right. If you kind of set that intention or you have that fear, then are you really having the experiences, or is something that, as you said, was just, strange phenomena, or just, you know, something that we would have casually cast off as just one of those things?
I'm saying you might really be having the experiences because you get yourself in an emotional state. You might actually move a couple of inches or something like that. It could be a trigger. I mean, for example, in the cage, apart from being an old creepy house, it was actually a place where there had been a genuine recent suicide. So if that's not enough to put newcomers to a house on edge, I don't know what is. If you go back to the Amityville Horror, a place of mass death, if that's not enough to put you on edge, I don't know what is. So I don't know if the Enfield tapes going round and round would put me on edge enough, but if you put the idea in my head enough, it might. Must try it.
You say, right, so then is that phenomena really something outside of you, or does it become a projection from you because you've got that concept rattling around in your brain?
If I'm right, big if, 90% of mediums and afterlife enthusiasts would disagree with me, of course, and they may be right. But if I'm right, yes, it would definitely be a projection from us. And that's why I love the Philip experiment so much, because they actually created a poltergeist. They knew they were summoning up somebody that hadn't died. They'd actually written the whole story about him. They gradually created phenomena just by talking about this character. And literally created a poltergeist out of nothing. No history, no ghost, no dead person, just by pretending something existed when it didn't.
That talks about then how powerful we truly are as people. And what do we bring to this? Is this phenomena even dead people, or are we powerful enough, and we just don't give ourselves credit, that we are projecting our own anxieties, fears, love, hate, greed, and it becomes a living, breathing entity of its own because of that?
I think they call them, don't they call them tulpas in the Far East, I think.
Thought forms, right.
Yeah, thought forms. I think it's perfectly possible, certainly not proven beyond all reasonable doubt, but it's a good it's a good place to start. That yes, we create our own poltergeists. They are us. They are our mischievous 2-year-old subconscious that's never really went away, that might want to try and predict the football. Well, maybe not at 2, but that might want to do silly things like try and predict football results, or just throw things around when to let off a bit of emotional stress. I talk about. There was a chap called Colin Wilson that wrote a book on poltergeists about 35 years ago, and he started off thinking, because of the rest of the writings, there were the power of the mind, and actually flipped his theory halfway through, apparently because of this black monk case. And I think I try in the book, or I certainly try in the book, to gradually flip it back, because everything fits together. I mean, you've got worldwide phenomena. You can create your own poltergeist. All you need is a instruction manual and a cardboard cutout, and off you go. And there is no real need to, and they don't do anything. I mean, I often say a poltergeist would be the last person you want sitting next to you in the pub, not because he would move your beer glass, because he or she wouldn't say anything of any interest. They're repetitive. They are. If it wasn't for the fact they create paranormal phenomena, they'd be deadly dull. You know, I mean, they don't do anything intelligent. So why do we think they're the afterlife?
I don't know. Fascinating stuff. The book will be out this August. We have a link. You can pre-order the book right now And make sure you check that out. There's also a link to our Amazon shop where you can find other great books on the paranormal as you're waiting for this one to arrive. You can also find cool swag, toys, games, clothing, accessories, and more. So make sure you click on that link. John, thanks for spending some time with us and going over the research and work that you put into this book so lovingly.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's been great. We'll be back again next week. We've got more of the best in Paranormal Talk Radio. And remember, next Thursday to watch Destination Fear Behind the Screams with the Destination Fear crew and myself on the Travel Channel, re-examining their first season. And of course, we'll be back on Tuesday with more True Crime Tuesday. You've been listening to the best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Darkness Radio.